This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasuthi. It's our Health and Living segment, Friday. Dr. George Lee in the studio. Welcome, George. How are you today? Thank you so much.
Yeah.
And we have joining us today as well, Dr. Kartini Abdul-Jabbar. She's from the Department of Medical Microbiology, Faculty of Medicine, University of Malaya. We have some interesting things to talk about today, both pretty much, you know, appealing to the man and the woman as well.
So absolutely.
Our phone lines are open. It's 0377109000. You can tweet BFM Radio or text 016-201-9000. The two articles, I'm going to start with the first one, gonorrhea. I think it came out in some research in Leeds shows that the number of, there's a bacteria in, gonorrhea is caused by a bacteria. And what's happening now is a certain antibiotic that's used to treat gonorrhea is now, the bacteria is becoming resistant to that antibiotic. And in Leeds, they're quite concerned because, you know, gonorrhea sometimes doesn't present symptoms. So there are people walking around, you know, continue to pass on the gonorrhea to other people. So they don't know the extent of which this is going on. And also, in the second piece of the news that we're going to be looking at is a new DNA sequencing device, size of a USB drive, used to detect urinary tract infections. And we know women are very prone to urinary tract infections. So what are some of your difficulties in you know, diagnosing UTI, as well as if you're concerned about gonorrhea, give us a call. You don't have to give us your name. Don't give us your name.
Just tell us you're your friend.
Yes.
You know, who's
so give us a call. We'll kick off the discussion with the gonorrhea. Now, what is this? Is this something we should be concerned about, George?
Right. Well, I'm awfully excited whenever.
I'm not. I'm alarmed. Excited.
Well, the thing is that, you know, this is very much up my alley. Mm-hmm. So I am relevant compared to last week where we talked about rabies. And yeah. I was like, I've never even seen the rabies.
But that was nation building.
Absolutely. Nation building.
It's
that's
helping
right.
all of us.
This is also nation building. You know, we're trying to prevent all these silent sufferers. And I'm very excited because today I have my ex-houseman who is now.
Poor Katia. She's traumatized because even before the mics came on, he was traumatizing
that's
the poor girl.
Right. That's right. And then, you know,
she's
obviously,
a microbiologist.
Absolutely. She's doing extremely well. She's a you know, lecturer in University of Malaya. And hopefully she's going to enlighten us a little bit. And I might learn something today, which is, you know, very important topics in, you know, about gonorrhea, really.
Kartini, Dr. Kartini, can you tell us a little bit more about this article and gonorrhea becoming, so the bacteria that causes gonorrhea becoming a little bit more resistant towards an antibiotic? Should we be alarmed?
Yeah, we should be alarmed. Gonorrhea is caused by a bug, which is called Neisseria gonorrhea, which is a gram-negative diplococci. Basically, the article that we have is it showed resistance to azithromycin and also third-generation cephalosporins.
Which are both antibiotics?
Yes, both are antibiotics. Mm-hmm. But over in Malaysia, we use a different set of standards for our clinical breakpoints in the microbiology lab. So we use the CLSI, which is Clinical Laboratory Standards Institute from the US, whereas over in the UK and Europe, they use UCAST. And they have standards, clinical breakpoints for azithromycin.
Can you elaborate a little bit about the differences, you know,
between the American and the UK standards?
Okay, the American and the UK standards. Over in the American standards, we don't have breakpoints for azithromycin.
What does that mean?
So that means we just don't have how to read whether it's sensitive or resistant based on the drug susceptibility.
Towards the bacteria.
Towards the bacteria.
Okay.
But we have it for penicillin, ceftriaxone, tetracycline, and fluoroquinolones. And over in Malaysia, we would treat it with ceftriaxone or cefepime and spectinomycin.
Mm-hmm. But does it matter that much? I mean, obviously, you know, diagnostically, there's one thing. But the thing is that this bug previously was, I mean, you don't remember this much, but, you know, in 1950s, that's in my time, right, no, not quite 1950s.
That's not true. You weren't even born
that's
yet.
That's right. Okay, I was born in 69. But actually, if you look at, you know, how the first condition that was used to treat bug. You know, penicillin actually treated the first condition was gonorrhea. You know, it's like, you know, newspaper headline in London, gonorrhea people are cured by penicillin anymore. Penicillin is no longer effective towards gonorrhea. Mm-hmm. And then in Malaysia, for example, I mean, I am a urologist, but in the UK, urologists don't treat sexually transmitted infection because they are a group of doctors called GU Medicine and they purely treat this condition. Obviously, in Malaysia, the setting is very different because many people go to dermatologists for sexually transmitted infection, believe it or not.
Why?
That's right. Because, you know, because they have all sorts of rashes coming out of different places. So they go to dermatologists. Otherwise, they go to urologists. Otherwise, they go to family medicine.
So does the dermatologist send them off to you?
No. They treat. That's right. Yeah. So the first port of call is dermatology in Malaysia. So, you know, one thing that it will be interesting to discuss is that we are facing potential drug resistance for a common infection. It's a common infection. I mean, you know, Western world or Eastern world, gonorrhea is common out there. So there's some filth going on around different places. But the thing is that the setup, is that conducive for treatment in Malaysia? You know, is that sort of like, environment, is it suitable to eradicate this condition or to treat this condition effectively? That will be a good, interesting point to discuss.
Do we know much? What can you tell me about the bacteria?
Well,
Dr. Gratia?
The bacteria, as I said, is gram-negative diplococci, and I'm just going to focus about the resistance because, as you said, in 1950s, they treated with penicillin, but based on the data, which is collected by the Institute of Medical Research, and it is published online in collaboration with Ministry of Health Malaysia, they actually tabulated that all of our total isolates of Neisseria gonorrhea, 50% is resistant to penicillin. And then there's an increasing trend of resistance towards ceftriaxone. So usually what we give is ceftriaxone, which is currently our line of treatment at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, majority of patients who present to me will probably receive one dose of intravenous ceftriaxone and then also 1 gram of azithromycin. And then if I really have suspicion that this won't, this will carry on, I might give them doxycycline for 1 week. So is that safe in Malaysia at the moment? Is that sort of treatment safe in Malaysia?
All three antibiotics?
For me,
wow.
That's because
you're leaving no stone unturned.
Because it is a condition that if it spread beyond a naughty boy to their partner, then it becomes very complicated. So you just want to make sure that they are eradicated. So is that the right way forward?
Yes, currently it is. But then unfortunately, because we don't test for azithromycin, we actually don't know whether it's still, do we have a growing resistance to its azithromycin or not. So this is actually a step backward rather than a step forward.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is that we have data in Ministry of Health to suggest that all the positive culture that you have for gonorrhea, we know that it's 50% resistant to penicillin.
Yep.
Okay. And then ceftriaxone?
And for ceftriaxone in 2012 was 1.8% resistant.
All right.
And then it increased to 2.2% the following year.
It's growing.
It's growing. That's right. Okay.
Oh, dear.
Right. Okay.
What will you do then? I mean, globally, we're facing an antibiotic resistance, whether it's tuberculosis and everything else. And what will we end up doing?
Well, that's the way for antimicrobial stewardship programs. What they do is that they restrict the usage of certain drugs, because now with the emergence of multi-drug resistant organisms, the WHO realized that bad bugs, no drugs. So you have a lot of bad bugs which are resistant to a lot of antibiotics, but you have no drugs to combat them.
Yeah.
So basically, we need to restrict the use of ceftriaxone, cephalosporin, ciprofloxacin, quinolones in other infections as well, to use it sparingly or with a targeted approach for therapeutic uses rather than just using it to every Tom, Dick and Harry.
Yeah,
but who would you just give it out to?
Well, the thing is,
if you don't have gonorrhea,
let's start with on the beginning again. Yeah. Right? Okay, Neisseria gonorrhea is a bacteria that actually harbors in probably 2/3 of women completely silently. Mm-hmm. Right? Okay, and then 10% of men, you are lucky or unlucky enough, you harbor it and you don't have any symptoms. But majority of men, 90% of men, will go to a clinic with constant discharge or pain when they urinate. And that is why they go and see doctors. And then, so obviously you can't carry on your day-to-day living with this pain when you urinate, and then they get themselves treated. But the situation is that majority in Malaysia, because we don't have a system like in Netherlands, for example, where people would just turn up to a clinic anonymously, get themselves treated, and then they're given medication to contact trace for that, and then so that they eliminate their partners or their misadventures, kind of like partners. And so what I am hoping Katini can tell us is that, is there any measures for us to limit that, you know, because in a Malaysian setting, we can treat this for one person, but treating that one person is not a solution. Mm-hmm. And of course, she highlighted that, you know, Ministry of Health restrict many medications. Obviously, intravenous medication can be restricted, but oral medication, we all know it's not restricted. So I'm interested to hear Katini's ideas about in University of Malaya, what sort of work she's doing, and also how our ministry looking forward to kind of like contain this condition. Because what we don't want is 10 years from today that this superbug is, you know, building up resistance, just like, you know, 30 years ago it was sensitive to penicillin and it's 50% resistant in Malaysia.
Are we doing any work, Dr. Katini?
Well, we are, because what happened was that starting September last year, the Ministry of Health Malaysia actually launched the antimicrobial stewardship program. And then starting in the middle of this year, they also launched another program, which is the Malaysian National Antibiotic Guidelines, which is a second edition. And this National Guidelines for Antimicrobials is also available on Google applications. And it's free, which means that everybody can just download it and then see what is the appropriate antibiotics they should be receiving.
Okay. I want to be devil's advocate.
That sounds like a lot of work.
Oh, you're going to be a devil's advocate.
I think that she knows that I was a nasty boss before, so I'm going to be nasty as well now. No, I'm going to ask you, in your opinion, I mean, obviously not too many people listen to this show, so you can say your opinion is like, how effective do you think guidelines for doctors and also guidelines for patients and also restrictions and with or without enforcement is working in Malaysia?
Well, with enforcement, they're not really enforcing it that well.
How do you enforce
exactly
something like this?
So, you know, we can come up with 1,000 guidelines, but if
you can't go around with a whip.
No, you
well,
can't.
Well, you can.
Okay, so let's then go back to the root cause of this. How do people contract gonorrhea?
Okay, let's hear from you.
It's sexually transmitted disease, so it's contracted to sexual activities, either oral or vaginal or through anal.
Mm-hmm. So I'm glad you said that, because people always assume that, you know, oral sex is safe, but it is not, because this condition is very infectious,
yes,
right?
And it is.
Kind of, it's in almost like 100% infection contact as long as you have bodily fluid exchange, even through oral sex, and then this is transmissible because it's a very, very infectious condition. If it's not treated, what sort of consequences are we looking at?
Well, if it's not treated, what happens is that first, like, for males, they might have the urethral discharge, and then much later on, it can disseminate through hematology spread, which means it goes through the bloodstream and it spreads all over the body. So it can be you can have very dire consequences, and ultimately, if the person ends up with epididymorchitis or something,
which is
the infections of the balls.
Okay.
Right. So naughty boys out there. So you get discharge, you get it spread to your bones and all on body because it might become septic because it might be. And many, many patients might actually get infections of the testicle. And I'm sorry, boys, but if you are not married or you don't have children, that might mean infertility in the future because they will block off all the reproductive tracts.
Okay. And when you have this poisoning in the blood by the infection,
septicemia.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. How do you treat that?
Well,
antibiotics again?
Yes, antibiotics again. But then you have no choice. You must use antibiotics. Even treating for this infection, you must use antibiotics. That's why you need to restrict the usage of this antibiotics for other causes. say, like, if the person has a pneumonia, a lung infection, which is community acquired, you don't need to give ceftriaxone. Yeah. You just give something simple like Augmentin. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The body can't fight this. It has to have an
antibiotic.
That's why if your body fights this, it will remain silent in your body for a long time, and then you are a reservoir for transmission. And that's why, you know, if 30% of the, you know, 70% of the populations, female populations, do not know they harbor this condition, there is a huge reservoir in the community that is spreading this condition.
That two-thirds of the female population harboring this bacteria is a scary thought.
It is a scary thought.
Are you saying it's lying dormant?
Yeah,
it can. Because for females, you don't actually manifest any symptoms. Mm-hmm. And then you can just have pelvic inflammatory disease, just some sort of pain, lower back pain, and that's about it. So, yeah, you could be harboring something.
Right.
Yeah, and then presumably for women, you also may have that consequence of sepsis and also the consequence of infertility whenever the bacteria started causing scarring in the pelvis, causing pelvic inflammatory disease. And then that is quite a dire, long-term, complicated, chronic disease.
Is it confirmed that with bacteria, with antibiotics, it will wipe out the bacteria?
At the moment?
Yes, at the moment, yes. But based on data from the UK, they've noticed that you can have quite difficult to treat Neisseria gonorrhea, so they would have to give it again and again and again, but then you have to think you don't have that many antibiotics to combat this, so you're running out of time. So it's a global approach, as in you treat this, but then you have to restrict the use for other things, because if it's being used all over the place, then the bugs might interact and they'd say, oh, you guys are resistant, I want to be resistant too.
Mm-hmm. Of course. Yeah. But of course, the solution is to go back to the root cause of this.
That's right. Okay.
For everyone to practice safe sex.
Absolutely. I mean, what alarms me a lot, right? Okay. I mean, I've got several questions that I would like to ask Katini, right? Okay. First of all, is that, why would something like this happen in the UK? Because there's a lot of restrictions on the antibiotic usage. The access to GU medicine is very, very prevalent. It can be anonymous. And why would you have an outbreak like that in Leeds, where when you have such strict control? If in Leeds we're faced with this super resistant gonorrhea, in Malaysia, we stand no chance.
Yeah, because we have no safeguards.
That's right. So I'm concerned. I mean, and also they take a lot of measure. If that is something that we detect in Malaysia, in the university setting, and, you know, if you are advising Ministry of Health, how do we control this? Because what the lead situation is that as soon as they found out all these 25 people who were in this situation, they vigorously grill them, trying to find their contacts, mm-hmm. hunt them all down, get it all eliminated so they control this. And how do we do that in Malaysia if we face this situation?
How do we control? By getting all the contacts.
Yeah, so first of all, how is Leeds kind of like getting themselves into trouble like that?
Well, I presume that they've been using the antibiotics for a much longer time period compared to Malaysia, because this happened over in the US and over in UK.
So what you're saying is that this is gonorrhea, it's more a Western disease, and then that is
passed. No, it's going to happen to us eventually.
No, right, eventually, okay. because we have more exposure towards the antibiotics.
Right.
So the longer the bug is exposed, they would develop some sort of resistance.
Okay.
They're slower at developing resistances. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so it's been around there longer.
Yeah.
We are just at a phase when the UK was maybe a couple of years back or a decade or so ago. Right. So I'm just making my own conclusions.
Yeah, so we've got something to look forward to.
To console myself. There's something called super gonorrhea. What is that? Is that different from the usual gonorrhea?
Yeah,
it flies around.
That's even worse.
Super gonorrhea. Basically, what happens is that they have some sort of gene mutations. So we are all made of some sort of DNA.
Yep.
So all these bugs, they have gene mutations, because once they are introduced to a drug, they would say, oh, I need to find a way to defend myself. So they've developed a way to defend. It's a defense mechanism. So once they have that mutation, later on, their offspring, they teach them the same thing. Okay, this is how I survived. You guys need to do the same.
Mm-hmm.
So this is how it spreads, and this is how it actually manifests. It manifests by being resistant. And that's how it's being called super gonorrhea, like all other super bugs.
Super gonorrhea apparently could be worse than HIV, do you think?
Well, I think any superbug would be
quite disastrous anyway. That's right. Yeah.
Because now even in HIV, you might have resistances. So it doesn't really matter what kind of organism it is. The mainstay is actually to do something about it. For STDs, sexually transmitted diseases, well, as you said previously, the way to go is to practice safe sex. Yeah. But apart from that, the antimicrobial stewardship program also plays a part by restricting the use of the drugs used for gonorrhea in other areas. If it's not needed in other areas, don't use it. Then you're using less of the drug. The bugs won't have any experience at all.
Okay.
They would be virgins.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Oh, never thought of a bug that way. But what about George? I mean, he uses first-line antibiotics, second-line antibiotics.
I'm glad you said, what about George? He uses first-line antibiotics. What about George's gonorrhea?
For his patients. Isn't that an abuse of antibiotics?
Because
say the right thing.
It's okay. It's like, you know, well, I often do think that, because on one hand, I'm looking at somebody who needs to eliminate this and I have one chance.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I'm overzealous and I am creating problems for myself and my patients later. So, you know, am I doing the wrong thing here that I will just kill the bugs with three rifles all out?
Three, I think the recommendation is only two.
All right, two. Okay,
it's already reaching
one
the guidelines.
Up. So, yeah, right. Okay, right.
But I understand your dilemma.
That's right.
You know,
yeah.
It's difficult yeah. to make that decision.
But yes. The thing is that doxycycline is probably building up a lot because it's such an old drug, right?
Yeah.
It probably has quite significant resistance anyway. So, you know, by using it, it's probably something that is more or less useless mm-hmm. in some sense.
Well, for tetracycline, we actually have developing resistances.
What sort of data are we looking at? Because we're looking at penicillin 50%. We're looking, you know, ceftriaxone about 2 to 3%. Is this from mycin in you don't have data for that?
No,
because
in Malaysia
we don't
test,
check that.
Yeah, we don't test. But for tetracycline, we don't have for doxycycline. We have for tetracycline. Mm-hmm. It's about 83% in 2013.
83% resistance.
Yes.
Oh, my God. That's right. Okay. This is how scary it is.
So, right, sex
that's
people.
Right. That's right. Okay,
yeah.
Right.
Oh,
okay. Well, actually, you know, the interesting thing, you know, obviously we have to move on to the urinary tract infections in a short while. But what I am concerned about is that the environment, that the ecology that we have in here for the health setup, the framework is not allowing patients to be treated sooner and not allowing too many patients to be treated. So, you know, a lot of people look at the Netherlands models because mm-hmm. Access to geomedicine is easy, contact tracing is easy, medication is easy, mm-hmm. follow-up to ensure that there's no more infection is easy, and also registered sex workers and constant monitoring of sex workers to ensure that the reservoirs is as diminished as possible. What's your view on that?
Okay, we're looking at models based on ideals.
Ideal. Yeah. It's a utopia that do you think we can, you know, I mean, the first thing that you highlighted that you worked so hard to create guidelines. Mm-hmm. If the guideline is not enforced, and I'm your ex-boss, and then, you know, I don't enforce that, I'm using an old dinosaur drugs that has 87% success rate. And then, second, if the guideline is not enforced, you're working hard for no real benefit, which is what I'm worrying about. So we need to tackle.
Do you think a register will work in Malaysia at the moment? I mean, we face already so much stigma and discrimination registering sex workers. I mean, it makes sense. You can then track a whole load of other STDs, you know. But is that, do you think that's something that will work?
I think it's a good idea, but I also think that it's a utopian idea because you have an influx of immigrants and you have an influx of people coming in and out of Malaysia. You don't have control over that.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't really control all the sex workers or casual sex workers, because there's no way. But the only other way is actually to educate the public and then decrease the stigma, because if you're shy about it, they don't come forward, and then you can't treat it. Mm-hmm. And it's very important to treat everyone at the same time, because if you miss one person, it might have dire consequences. They might actually get disseminated, it goes into the blood, they fall very sick. And by the time you identify it, because cultures usually take about 3 to 5 days, you might be too late.
Yeah. Why does the culture take such a long time?
You need bugs to grow. They need all the nutrients and everything overnight.
Is this bug culturable? Because it's supposed to be an intracellular diplococcus, is that right? Or is that the chlamydia?
That's the chlamydia. Neisseria gonorrhea is culturable, but it's very fastidious. So they need extra stuff. They need chocolate agar and something. Or modified.
Never thought of a bug that way.
That's right. Yeah. They need to be enticed a little bit more to see whether they grow or
chocolate
not.
Chocolate and virgins.
That's right.
Oh, wow. the bug is good.
Now we're looking at gonorrhea in a different light altogether, right?
Absolutely. So, so what you're saying is to at least, you know, reduce the stigma so people can come and get treated. Yeah. That would be the first thing to do, actually.
Yeah.
But I think our younger generation, they're not really stigmatized by this. They actually come forward. The only problem is that the older generation are the ones playing hooky.
Yeah, she's looking at me. In the younger generations, I actually think that Gen Y treat this.
She can't stop laughing.
Sorry, I know.
Older
generation.
I'm sending him off to a geriatrician.
That's right. Well, not too long. It's like, you know, I like that, because I really think that Gen Y, to consider that this is not a taboo, it's a condition that needs to be treated, need attention, and then when there's no barrier, then we have a future. And also, it's up to Gen Y to feel that sense of obligation that I do not want to bow to taking antibiotics from unauthorized sources. I don't want to take it. I want it to be prescribed. I want it to be monitored. I want to prove that I have eliminated this condition. And I really think that's a way forward.
That's very interesting about how the younger generation is happy to come forward.
Why?
That just opens up another discussion altogether.
I think it's because they have more access to its more information.
Mm.
So when they know what's important and what's not really important, and they know that having gonorrhea is going to be an important issue, so they would know that they would need treatment for it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I deal with many sufferers who are suffering in silence because they are so scared. They're thinking about 1,001 other infection that is associated with this because they made one mistake in their lives. And then I think that itself, it's a completely complex psychological torture, because on one hand you don't want to be judged by the doctor you go and see, and then on the other hand, and then you are just suffering in silence, and then because you have no idea what else you have contracted. Mm-hmm. And I really think that's a torture.
I ain't coming to you. Go to somebody you really don't know.
All right, exactly. Yeah.
See,
that's right.
Taboo, stigma.
Yeah,
isn't it?
But I get patients from the other side of town coming to me because, mm-hmm. you know, they just worry that they might get seen, you know, in the local area. So you know, there are all sorts of ways to kind of avoid being identified.
Okay, we spoke about the worst thing that could happen to men if they don't get it treated. What happens to the women?
Well, it's about the same thing, only it happens in a woman, like the pelvic inflammatory disease, and then they get scarring, and then they might also get infertility. And then if it goes into the blood, then they might get it into the bloodstream, they might fall really sick, and then, yeah.
If it harbors, when does it strike? When you're immunocompromised?
No, it doesn't.
It just stays there all the time, and it just spreads and spreads and spreads.
Okay, very
I've seen healthy people with disseminated gonorrhea, and they're young. And that person was unaffected. He just said, yeah, I have it. But then his mom was a bit upset.
Keep your mom out of this.
That's right. Because sometimes, you know, you get parents bringing children in. And I said children, but, you know, older kids. Well, because number one, the young adults don't really know what they have contracted.
Okay.
Number two, the parents always wanted to, you know, traditionally they always take their kids to go and see doctors, and they just assume this is an infection that they want to get involved and then and also pay for their expenses and things like that. And then as soon as they found out this person has actually started sexual activities, then there's a lot of discussions in that evening in that household.
Which is, I suppose, a good thing.
It is a good thing. Yeah. And then, but the thing is that, you know, it takes a little bit of infection to get that started. Probably should have done that before the infection was initiated, right?
I'm just very curious. When a parent and, you know, young adolescent comes to you, George, who do you ask the first question?
Who do I ask them?
Yeah, the parent or the child?
It's a very sensitive situation, right?
Let me guess, you always ask the parent, right? You direct the question to the parent first.
No. No matter how young the child is, I always talk to the patient, right? Okay. And then, but if this was a very sensitive subject, I will work around the subject and then eventually trying to find suitable opportunities where I am with the patient without the parents, and I'll ask all the real questions.
Okay, all right. Okay, we're discussing gonorrhea just now. We're going to move on and talk about urinary tract infections. There's a little device, DNA sequencing device size of a USB drive, apparently, that has come to be, which will help detect urine samples for UTI. So we'll have that discussion up next. If you have a question on gonorrhea as well, give us a call. The number is 0377 109000. You can tweet BFM Radio or text 016-201-9000. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasothi. Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist in the studio with us, together with Dr. Kartini Abdul-Jabbar. She's from the Department of Medical Microbiology, Faculty of Medicine, University of Malaya. We're discussing two topics today, gonorrhea as well. And now we're moving on to urinary tract infections treatment, all of which very much up Dr. George's alley. And I wanted to find out from Dr. Kartini, this new DNA sequencing device, size of a USB drive. What's all the hype about it?
Okay, actually it's been around for a few years, but then it was officially unveiled over in ICAC, which is international conference for antimicrobials and chemotherapy over in San Diego. And this conference is a big thing because it's organized by two organizations, which is ISID, International Society of Infectious Diseases, and also ASM, which is American Society of Microbiology. So every year they have this big conference, and this
and everyone
time,
waiting to launch their PSR resistance.
Yeah, that's when they start selling whatever products that they have. So this thing is a nanopore sequencer, which basically what happens is that, as I said previously, every bug or every person, they have DNA. So what you do is that they extract that DNA, and then the reading, that's what the USB gadget is for, is to read all the sequences, and then after that, they churn out the results in 12 hours.
All right.
So it's fast.
It's fast. Okay. So essentially,
so I can do it at home? No.
No, you still have to extract and everything, so it's a lot of equipment still.
So you're extracting blood or urine?
For DNA sequencing, theoretically, you can extract a lot of things, but it's just a process on how you extract it. So for this one that in the article that was given, is from the urine. Mm-hmm. So in the urine, basically what you have is probably just a bug, because if it's cloudy, it's going to be a lot of bugs. So they cut up the bug, they run it through, and then the sequencer just reads it. And then it gives you a result.
Let me get this right, okay? Essentially, it's just like a pregnancy kit. And then you kind of like dip it in there. And then, you know, 12 hours later, you get a result saying what sort of bugs you have. No?
It's like a high-tech pregnancy kit, which requires some sort of lab work.
Oh, you still require lab work.
You can't do it at home, George.
Like, because what it says in there was like, you know, this instant, you know, identifier, and then you suddenly say, so, you know, the immediate thing is like, you know, I read through the data and I was going, okay, right, from my imagination, it is just that you pee into a bottle, you dip in there, and then it will come out and say, okay, E. coli. Not quite.
If only.
Yes. Well, maybe like 50 years down the line, maybe it'll be
like that. 50 years.
What about traditional ways of detecting?
Yeah, exactly. Explain to the listeners a little bit.
Basically, what we do, we have culture. We also have the urine FEME, which is basically the microscopy of it. So they would need to look at both. But for culture, it's kind of difficult because what we do is that we separate out how many colony forming units per mil that you can read. And then if it's a high number, then
I'm glad you're here today because I get many patients who have recurrent urinary tract infections. Mm-hmm. So I want you to clarify two things. Number one is that, you know, they always ring up the clinic because obviously they're anxious. They say, look, you know, have we got the results? Have we got the results? So what I would like you to do is just explain a little bit as soon as they send the urine off, what sort of long processes that you go through in order to identify what bug and what sensitivity. That's the first thing. And the next thing I also want you to say is what any advances to treat a lot of listeners out there and patients who suffers from recurrent urinary tract infections.
Okay. So what happens over in the lab is that when we receive the specimen, it needs to be a fresh specimen, preferably from that day itself. Or if they need to keep it overnight, then it has to be refrigerated. And then what happens is that over in our lab, we put a dipstick in it, and then after that we put it on our agar plate, and then after that it's incubated for the next day, 24 hours, and then the next day it is read. Now the problem is that we have differing ways of interpretation from lab to lab. So for UMMC, what happens is that if it's single, it's just one type of organism from the plate, then, and if it's a significant number, then they would continue to process it. But if it's mixed, this is where the difficulty comes in. Over in our center, we basically, if it's mixed, we don't process it further. It's just released out as mixed coliforms or mixed culture. But some other centers, they actually look at a predominant organism, and then they would actually try to identify that predominant organism. This is the difficulty because sometimes it might be important to know the predominant organism, but, and sometimes it might not be helpful because
there's just too many.
There's so many urine cultures in a day. And ultimately, it's back to the person treating the patient, whether the symptoms
For a lab like UMMC, how many urines do you go through in a day?
I think about 40 to 50.
Per day.
Yeah.
All right.
Our total number of lab for all our lab specimens is about 300,000, which is about 100,000 more from the past 5 years ago.
300,000 over
specimens.
Over the last?
It's 100,000 more compared to 5 years ago.
Okay.
Over 5 years, 300,000.
So this is over
one year.
300,000 a year.
300,000 specimens per year. You're doing a lot more than 40 per day.
Yeah, that's much more than 40 a day.
That's for all specimens.
All right, okay.
So our urine, we also have a lot. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, they do it really fast. And but at the end of the day, no matter what you grow, you still have to tally it with what person's having.
Mm. So it's a clinical correlations.
Yes.
I'm very curious. 300,000 specimens, what do you do with the cultured bacteria after?
Incinerate it.
Do you really?
Yeah, we incinerate most of them.
I think that's a legal requirement.
Those which are multi-drug resistant, we actually stock them in case that in future we need to do some sort of research to see what kind of resistance is, how they develop and all that. It might be helpful in our future treatment and all.
Dangerous place. It's all growing in there.
These microbiologists.
That's
watch
right.
Them
there's a watch them.
With
because,
a
you know,
eye.
That's right.
But George also mentioned, oh, sorry, we have LTY on the line. Hi, LTY, you have a question.
Good afternoon, Mila.
Good afternoon.
Dr. George.
Good afternoon. Yeah,
Good afternoon, Dr. Chagani.
Yes.
My question is regarding UTI, okay? I wish to raise 3 points, all right?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
George, this is your ball game, all right?
It is my ball game.
UTI is, in manner, is quite is uncommon. Mm-hmm. And the underlying problem could be prostatitis or STI, all right?
Mm-hmm.
My second point is UTI may be symptomatic or non-symptomatic. A sudden deterioration of mental state in the elderly like me, okay, may be an indication of the presence of an infective process that is UTI.
Mm-hmm.
The third point is residual volume of urine which can happen to me also, elderly, in the bladder, an abnormality to the structure with UTI or calculus. Stone, not in mathematic calculus, all right? also increase the risk of infection. Kindly comment, Dr.
Okay.
George. Thank you.
Thank you very much, LTY.
Thank you.
I think LTY is a urologist in disguise.
I know. Uncommon in men.
It is very uncommon in men. Second, you get 10 women and one man who gets that. So there is a study that was done a while ago to say that cutoff is 40. Anybody who's below 40, you get UTI. This is likely to be STD. If this is anything that's above 40, it's likely to be big prostate. So it's those men who actually bang on around 40. We can't decide whether you're naughty or you're just old.
Okay. Can you hold that thought? We're going to come back after a quick market update and address some of LTY's questions. Up next, if you have a question, give us a call. The number is 03-7710-9000. Tweet BFM Radio or text 016-201-9000. Good afternoon. And if you've just joined us, welcome. It's Friday. Dr. George Lee, consultant neurologist in the studio. And we have today Dr. Kartini Abdul-Jabbar from the Department of Medical Microbiology, Faculty of Medicine, University Malaya, discussing right now about UTI, urinary tract infections. We had a discussion about gonorrhea, the bacteria that causes gonorrhea becoming more resistant towards certain types of bacteria, and alarming indeed. I think all of us should be concerned about that. Now, just moving on to UTI, it's always a problem diagnosing because it takes a long time to actually culture the bacteria and to decide whether or not somebody is in fact suffering from UTI. So now they've come up with a new DNA sequencing device the size of a USB drive, which could possibly speed up that process. Do you think it's really going to speed up the process?
Well, it'll speed up, but then you still need the technical people for it. Technical personnel for it, because it's all lab work and it's a DNA sequencer at the end of the day.
So it sounds awfully expensive.
It is.
I'm sure it is.
Because it's all molecular work.
All right. Mm-hmm.
So yeah.
Anything that says DNA is expensive.
<That's right.
laughs> Till we get to research and, you know, many, many years to come.
So this is another utopia. We talk about one utopia before.
No, we'll get there.
We'll get there.
Yeah, like everything else.
So, like,
Think about computers. Like the 1970s, they might be really expensive. And they're huge and they're bulky.
All right.
But now you can just get it in like what?
I'm just worried I don't have that long.
You're living to 250, remember?
I do try.
You
with
have
all
made
that infection.
Declaration.
With that, all that infections, I don't think I'm going very far.
We did spoke about, LTY did speak about mental state and
I mean, UTI. In fact, one of the things that, you know, we're talking about geriatric patients earlier on. I mean, you know, Kartini probably will just tell you that in any institution, if you have, like, say, care homes, anyone, if we have a confused person, male or female, I think there's a good chance it's either urinary tract infection or chest infection.
What does that mean?
It means that basically in the elderly person, you might not get a proper history. It's very difficult to get proper history. And usually for diagnosis, 90% of the time, if you get a good history, you get your diagnosis easy. But if it's a little frail old man or a little frail old lady and they can't really tell you what they did and what happened, they can't give you any sequences, no chronological order, and they're in confused, you don't know what's happening. What you do is that you just do a septic workout, which is basically you check the blood for cultures, you check the urine for cultures, you send sputum for cultures, whatever, you check the lungs. And then after that, you just bang with some sort of empiric therapy, whatever's first your impression is, bang it with some sort of antibiotic.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, this is quite a common practice. And then sometimes poor old ladies or men who actually continue to get confused, but when they receive the right antibiotics, they are normal again. And then so this is what LTY was highlighting.
But you don't really know what you treated.
That's
because
right.
Because you just found a bacteria.
Not necessarily. I mean, because it's just like, you know, if the care home people just say, you know, this person is just confused. But the thing is that don't just take on its face values because there's a reason behind the confusion. It's not just dementia all the time.
Yeah. Okay. All right. That's interesting. And the last thing he said was about
anatomical. Yeah. Okay. Essentially, you know, he's right that all men, if you live old enough, you're going to get prostate problem. And then one of the prostate problems actually is you don't empty your bladder completely, and that reservoir that's left behind is a source of infection. And that infection, you know, or anatomical problems such as stones, or you have any problems in your anatomy, then you're more likely to get other infections.
Yeah, so because what happens is that the urine has that stasis of the urine, which means that the urine is just stuck there. They can't move around. They're floating around. And then when it's floating around there, what happens is that it can get infected. And that's how you end up with a urinary UTI. Tract infection.
And why does UTI keep recurring for women?
Mm. For women, basically for women, young sexually active women, they get urinary tract infections. But the difference between females and males is that they're anatomically different. So the urethra is shorter, and it is more likely to get infected.
Yeah. Well, essentially, women have four phases that they are more prone to infections. One is childhood, and then in childhood, they get reflux, more common than boys. And then the second phase, perhaps, is during sexual activities. It's called honeymoon cystitis, mm-hmm. funnily enough. And then the third phase actually is during pregnancy. You can imagine that during pregnancy, there's a lot of reflux of pressure of urine mm-hmm. to the kidney. And lastly, is postmenopausal. So short straw, I'm afraid.
Okay, all right. And the device, the USB device, also detects resistance to antibiotics. Am I correct?
Yeah, the resistance is because it's DNA. What happens is that they would detect the resistance genes.
Oh, you can identify mutations to
yeah,
see what sort of
mutations.
Oh, wow.
But then you see, the thing is that you want to see the resistance on the plate, because then you would know, oh, for this antibiotic, it's not going to work. You don't have resistances for all antibiotics. So that might be a shortfall, because you can't test for everything. You can only, and then for in future, there might be new research. They might find out, oh, there are other resistant genes. So this is the difficulty. But I think what they're going to do is that they're going to keep on updating it, and they're going to improve it. And it would be a bit more efficient, and it would also have a wider spread over what kind of resistances you can detect.
Are you excited about it?
It's expensive, not really.
Lukewarm. I can sense that.
There are potential problems as well in terms of detecting.
But just think of it as a 1970s computer, right? You know, it's like 40 years down the line, it is some excitement, right?
It's benefiting all of us. It will benefit our children
Absolutely.
Or our grandchildren, George.
Yeah.
So we're going to close with your advice for prevention of STIs and UTIs.
So for STIs, safe sex.
Right, okay. Nothing else. That's it. Or no sex.
As simple as that. It's up to you, George.
Okay, right. And then for recurrent urinary tract infection?
Well, for recurrent urinary tract, as I don't really have much advice. Maybe you could give
better advice. Right, okay, right, okay. Now it's on my last words, right?
Yes.
Actually, I'm so proud of you. And I was like, she did urology, and she was so inspired that she actually had to carry on doing microbiology about urology and urinary
infection. Yes, I know. She's a reflection of how good you are.
That's right. Okay. All right. Before she came in, she was terrified. You know, when I told her that I was going to grill her, she said, this is like an exam. So it's an end, right?
No, it's like an award round again.
So, was it as painful as you thought?
No.
Not really. Not that bad.
Yeah,
that's absolutely. Yeah. No, she has got calming effect on me before I get too naughty.
Your message.
All right. See? Well, I'm very excited about this, you know, and I'm also excited about these because urinary tract infection is always perceived as a not too sexy medical subject, you know, urinary tract infection per se. However, it is a real threat when you see that 87% of tetracycline actually is, is resistant to tetracycline. I really think that is a real threat, and then I really am quite pleased with a lot of work that you guys are doing in UMMC, and keep up with great work.
Thank you both.
Thank you much.
Thank you both very much for joining me today. Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, and Dr. Kartini Abdul-Jabba on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.